I love that example because I think a big mistake we do as parents is try to make things too hard, too difficult, too exhausting, and we're burnt out, and then we don't get the results. If I've learned anything on all the work on resilience, number one is that thrivers are made, not born. And number two, ordinary, simple little things can make extraordinary differences if you intentionally do them in the moment.
And if you want to be a part of the conversation too, then subscribe to my Patreon, www.patreon.com/Mr. Chaz, and join the conversation. Ask your own questions. Be a part of it for as low as $5 a month and get access to one-on-one coaching with me for as low as $20 a month.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching podcast, where I introduce you to the people that can help you on your leadership, parenting, and teaching journey. That took like three times for me to do that. But today we have Michelle, Dr. Michelle on, and I'm just going to go ahead and let her introduce herself, and then we'll get started with the conversation. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. I'm Michelle Borba. I'm a 1L Michelle. Borba rhymes with Zorba, so you'll always remember me the rest of your life. But in any case, I'm an educational psychologist. I'm based in California, and my whole life's mission has been to try to figure out why some kids struggle and others shine. I started as a special needs teacher, and I saw that despite really severe difficulties, some kids were still making it. And then I got turned on to some research that changed my life at the University of California, Davis. It was a woman named Mimi Werner who had the same question that I had, and I know everybody else in the world right now knows and has. How come some kids are able to bounce back? Is resilience teachable? What she did, Mr. Jazz, was study about 600 kids for 40 years. All of them were growing up in extremely adverse situations. And the good news is about 10 years into it, she discovered that about a third of them were bouncing back despite sexual abuse, schizophrenic parents, extreme adversity. And then it was the why. And that was my takeaway. There was two things. Number one, they always had caring champions in their life, and it wasn't the parent. It was a teacher or a coach or the neighbor next door who refused to give up on that kid. We all need caring champions. But the second thing was that the kid had learned protective buffers, like how to reduce the stress or how to find the hobby or what's my go-to or what's my strength. And those buffers helped reduce the stress and the anxiety so the kid could get over the mountain and through and keep on going. I think that's what I discovered, is that kids these days are kind of missing those buffers. Thrivers, the book, is all, each one of those is one of the seven chapters. Each chapter is one of the seven strengths of thrivers and how to teach them. So this pandemic generation is going to make it.
So I got to ask, what are those buffers? You mentioned that it was a caring relationship, wasn't a parent, it was a teacher, it was someone else.
Yes.
And you said it was these buffers. What were the buffers?
The buffers, first of all, were come up with seven different strengths, and then the buffers came part of it. So the first thing is, if we want a new parenting plan, and by the way, leadership, you'd use the same thing in the business world as well as in the classroom. It starts with the level of it is self-confidence, knowing what my strengths are, not what mom wants me to become, but who I am as a person. If you look at the business world, one of the top things that they now ask every new employer to do is figure out what your strengths are. Unfortunately, 77% of the time, we focus on our kids' weaknesses, not their strengths. So step one is rebooting them so they know who they are and they're more likely to be able to handle the challenge that comes up. Then the second one would be empathy. The ability to be a we thinker, not a me thinker. And we now know if you keep giving self-absorbed and it's all about you, your stress level goes up to the brink and your burnout goes up to the top. So in a diverse world like we are right now, we better be open to ideas and possibilities and people. And that's what it is. Apparently, resilient kids have social competence. Doesn't mean they have 50,000 friends, but they can attract a couple of loyal buddies, and that's going to help them get through. The third one, every kid in the world needs it. So too does every parent. self-control. How do you manage and regulate stress? And that is, again, teachable, but that's being able to put the brakes on impulses. Fourth is integrity. Fascinating. I didn't realize this was going to keep coming up. But as your kids get older, they're going to be faced with adversities like peer pressure, moral dilemmas. And if you know what you stand for and who you are, it's going to be a heck of a lot easier to say, stop doing that, or no, I'm not going to. And then you can move ahead. I love the fifth one. It's curiosity and openness. You're a problem solver. So when the challenge hits, you don't raise the white flag. You go, I'm going to try this instead. And if we've been rescuing and helicoptering our kids all this time, it isn't going to help our kids in terms of resilience. From this moment on, never do for your child what your child can do for themselves. And it's going to help them develop that agency, which is core to resilience. The sixth one is perseverance. So you have a challenge. One little thing of I'm going to start doesn't mean you're going to get over the bump. You got to keep on going. And it's effort that's going to help you succeed. According to every bit of research out there, you help the kid develop a growth mindset. And finally, nobody's going to deny this one is important, optimism and hope. How do you help kids develop optimism and hope when there's, oh my gosh, a live war feeds going on every day? You turn on a TV and there's how many people have died today, racial injustice. Oh my gosh, the things that kids have seen in the last 2 years. But every one of those seven are teachable. They're made up of simple strengths. The goal is not to teach them tonight, or your kid will never let you read another book, but instead dig into what you think your kid needs, turn to that chapter, and then find one little habit that you want to instill in your kid, because it's habit by habit that creates resilience.
Okay, wow. Okay, so you have self-confidence, empathy, self-control, integrity, curiosity, perseverance, and optimism.
There you go.
Okay, so now we know what it is. How do we teach it? How do we teach those things? I imagine you, with each of the different kind of skills there, you teach them differently, or do you teach them all the same?
No, you teach them all differently, and you teach them based on who your kid is and where your kid is. And by the way, I've got three kids that are as different as night and day. So you may have to do a different parenting plan for each child, but that's what parenting is, right?
Yeah.
Start with self-confidence, because that's sort of the easiest one. I know that a listener will go, oh my gosh, do we have to have all seven of those? No, it's a rare grown-up that has all seven. But the more you have, the better, because they buffer the stress and they amplify. So one little point, and then we'll like, my aha moment when I was writing Thrivers was always to say, what's the order you teach them? And I finally realized there wasn't an order. You dig into what your kid needs, what you're already doing, pat yourself on the back. What do you need, or what your kid need? That's where you start. But as soon as you start adding the second one in any order, it creates a multiplier effect, which means the two together are going to be far more powerful than one alone. Third is going to make your kid into a superpower. So there you go. Starting with number one, self-confidence. I think the bottom on this one is the fascinating thing that Emmy Werner said, and it isn't just Emmy Werner. There's scores of phenomenal researchers. Many children who suffer from adversity but can bounce back have hobbies, and the hobby helps them decompress the stress. Many of us discovered that. I mean, you know, in the olden days, Great Aunt Hattie taught me knitting. I got the knitting needles out when COVID hit because I found that's what helped me. What you've got to do is figure out what helps your child. That isn't the whole part of confidence, but one part of it is making sure your kid has a go-to that's healthy, and it's not just digital devices. It could be, for instance, you taking a 3x5 card. Be sneaky and walk around the house for the next couple of weeks. When does your child have a little more eagerness in what he's doing? His tone is more excited in what he's doing. He learns whatever that is a little easier. Oh my gosh, when the soccer camp was shut down during COVID, you saw actual depression. Now what am I going to do? Not because he wanted to have it on his college resume, but because he loved doing it. So the first thing is, find your child's passion. And if you can't figure it out, don't worry about it. Now is the time that as a family, Maybe you can start introducing things as a family. Figure out what your everybody's go-to. Could it be, let's do board games, or let's do guitar, or let's do yoga. Introduce them. Figure out what your child likes. This is, you can get grandma involved. Great Aunt Hattie can get involved. Another aunt or uncle can get on board and do Zooming on teaching your kid baking if you're not so good at it. It makes no difference what the hobby is. But the first thing is figure out what the child's strength area is and carve in time in that busy day of yours to let every family member go, even if it's 15 minutes, go to it, because it's an amazing stress reducer.
So be a facilitator of their hobbies and introduce them to different hobbies if they don't have one. And you can do this during family time. Something that I've heard a lot of people say is that they love to hike because they've always did hiking with their families, the family trips growing up. So I think that's really good. And I know that for, me personally, I can remember many times in my life where it was whether it was something, I was young and I was going through something with a girl, or it was, a different situation. I turned to kind of my like writing for me was one of those. And like poetry for me was one of those things that really helped me kind of work through a lot of my own stuff. And, fast forward years later, it's not only is it something that's still a hobby, it's also something that helped me build other skills too.
That's exactly what confidence does. You start with knowing what you're good at and everything else becomes easier because you've got this base. And you and me are alike, because my mother gave me a journal when I was 5, and that's how I became the writer. It helped me process, but that doesn't mean that it's going to help the other kid. You've got to figure out what works for that particular child. And that's the decompressor. Ideas along the way. I was interviewing teens, Natalie from Dalton. Oh my gosh, she's absolutely a gold mine. I said, okay, Natalie, what helps you? She says, music. I said, what kind of music? She says, well, I'm not so good at playing it, but I'm really good at listening to it. And I discovered it's Mozart. I said, what's so good about Mozart? She said, I don't know. But as soon as I loaded my iPad with it, it soothes me and it's my go-to. And now my mom is helping me learn piano based on a YouTube tape. So that's wonderful. Where another kid, it's going to be a whole different forte. It could be hiking. I want to take a moment on that hiking. They did a really interesting study in New York City of the kids during COVID who had to take the bus to school versus the same kids who walked through the park. Which kid was far less stressed by the time they got to school? Hiking through the park. So ordinary things can also make extraordinary differences. This thing on resilience is not a program or another fancy app or a tutor. It's finding what works for your kids and tuning it in and making it part and parcel of your family.
Okay, so let's go to the next one. How do you teach empathy?
Empathy, number one, is you start with the gateway to it is emotional literacy. It's real hard to feel with another person unless you can go, oh, he looks happy, or she looks frustrated, or he sounds upset. The problem is our kids are learning emotional literacy off of emojis, and it doesn't transfer so well when you're looking at the face. But the first thing is, if you can want to feel with a person, you have got to start in your own home, talking emotions far more. By the way, that's the starting point of empathy, is self-compassion. For a kid to be able to say to mom, I'm feeling angry, or I'm frustrated, or am I stressed? That's a goldmine for parenting, because now you know how your kid feels. Mm-hmm. One little thing on that one that's fascinating. We do a far better job of talking emotions with our 2-year-old daughters than we do with our 2-year-old sons, says Yale. Mm-hmm. It just keeps creating this pink-blue divide that by the time the kid goes to kindergarten, girls are so much more superior in emotional vocabulary. And that's a high correlation to academic achievement and to stress reduction. Now, that's the starter point of it. Another thing that is absolutely incredibly simple. Excuse me as I choke. I hope you can cut this.
We don't cut anything out. This is all.
Well, doggone it. books. What they've discovered is that literary fiction, which we've known for years, Bambi, Charlotte's Web, I don't care what the book is, Outsiders, actually helps project your child into another world. and how glorious that is. It's bibliotherapy, healing kids or understanding different views. So my next thing to you is, you want an empathetic kid? Then mix up the books you're reading. You have a boy, start making sure that some of the characters are girls. Make sure there's different demographics, there are different zip codes, there are different races, there are different cultures. We have got to expose our kids at a much earlier age so people begin to, and kids begin to see how we're alike, not how we're different. That's another one, and could be all kinds of possibilities. The other thing about empathy is that there's three kinds, Mr. Chaz. One is affective. You can see that in a child. Your friend gets bullied and they come running in and their whole face is distressed. Affective empathy starts a little earlier, but if your kid isn't crying through Bambi, it doesn't mean that they don't have empathy. The second kind is cognitive empathy. Harvard says that's the top employability factor. Getting into the shoes of the client, but as you're younger, getting into the shoes of the character or dad or the kid next door, how would you feel if that happened to you? What would you need in order to feel better? How great to be able to do that with the news. Flip it from different views and get into not judging, but saying you don't have to approve or agree, but you have to try to understand where the other person's coming from. Boy, that would be a gold mine in this world. The third one is compassion in action. And that would be the B. So we got the A, B, C. A is affective, B is behavior, C is cognitive. One of the best stress reducers there is in the world is altruistic suffering. If you've got some concerns and stress, don't hold it in, give back. For instance, I've got so many kids who told me that during COVID, they were so distressed. Kids, and this is high school teens in Glenbard. They said they were so worried about some of their peers that they created a list of who they worried about with the anxiety and the stress and the depression. And then they created driveway drop-off bags. And what the heck is that? He says, well, we just divvied it up. One kid's good at baking, so she baked the cookies and put it in the bag. The other kid's great at writing a note, and he put the note in. The other one decorates, and I just dropped it off at the driveway. I said, how'd it go? He said, it was absolutely amazing. Every single day, one of those kids would call us up sobbing, saying, thank you, I didn't know anybody cared. And every single day, we'd cry because they cried. And every single day, we had to do another driveway drop-off bag. We never have felt so good because we realized we could do something to make somebody else feel better. That's the power, transformational, of empathy.
Yeah. Yeah. How does empathy impact, how does it impact ourselves when we're giving empathy, right? I have two questions. Okay. One, what are the barriers to giving empathy to another person? And two, what are the benefits from giving empathy to another person?
Oh, well, let's start with the benefits and let me count the ways. Number one, what we do know, it is not a soft and fluffy skill. It's transformational. It's one of the best ways to reduce stress. It's highly correlated to resilience. You want a more humane world, then you boost empathy. You want a kid who's actually better in a classroom, who's more engaged and a deeper thinker. You have got to be able to get into the perspective of the history book, the scientist, the mathematician, or the teacher to be able to understand the other view. It's the top employability factor, says Harvard. And if you look at the Fortune 500 companies of what is the future skills that our kids need to be world ready, collaboration is one of the four that keeps coming up. So empathy, it's not soft and fluffy. It's critical. Now, a danger is when we have too much empathy and we don't take care of ourselves. And some kids have that. Mm-hmm. And I love Mother Teresa. She had the best solution. She said, if I kept looking at all the kids who were dying and starving, I'd be so overcome, I couldn't do it. So I trained myself just to look to one. And that protected me so I could not stop being empathetic, but go towards that one, then the next, then the next. That seemed to be very helpful. Many of our kids, the other thing about empathy is they said, I feel really upset. I feel with that person, but I didn't know what to do. So I think we don't make assumptions. We brainstorm with our kids. One thing you can do is console the person. I'm so sorry that that happened to you. A, you could ask, how are you feeling? Or what can I do for you? Or you could absolutely respond by saying, can I help by taking you to the teacher? Or can I report this with you? An E is you just empathize. That's care, C-A-R-E, if you haven't figured out my acronym there. But E is, you know, I felt that way, or you didn't deserve that. Or if you need anything, I'm here for you. And you can always tell a child, please, if this happened yesterday, it's not too late to help tomorrow.
I love that. Let's go to the next one. You're just a goldmine of information and quotes. I love it. I love it. Tell me about self-control. How do you teach self-control, especially to young children who are by their nature very impulsive? And I know one of the things that gets brought up a lot is the self-control that children don't have. And I would argue children and adults struggle with self-control in a grocery store. And that ends up, that creates very interesting scenes and very stressful scenes for children and parents alike, where they're, you know, feeling like they're judged. But, you know, tell me, how do we teach self-control?
I'm laughing at the grocery store because my favorite one on this one is what we do wrong on self-control.
Yeah.
Every single holiday season, you see the kid in the toy store aisle having the absolute exorcism because the mother won't give him the toy, right?
Yeah.
And then the kid is just flailing with the exorcism and the mother's saying, calm down. The big thing about self-control is you don't wait until the meltdown. Yeah. The first step is every kid's going to be different. Every kid has a little bit different between, I don't care if he's 43 or three when I'm talking kids, but the first thing is recognize your child's stress signs and your own, because kids are not stressed 24/7. They're stressed, first of all, at certain particular points. They're more likely to be distressed if they're hungry, if they want attention, if they're bored, they're sleepy. Those are the kinds that we know are more likely to predict it. So sometimes you can get rid of the outburst by just predicting, when is this kid and what does he need? The second thing is recognize his signs. And every kid's going to be different. There is a slow buildup in stress. And what you've got to do is catch it before it gets into the exorcism. Some children, seriously, you can see at age four, you can see their little feet go up and down. I've seen kids start to grind their teeth, or I see tween girls tell me they go like this, or they start wiping their fists back and forth because they get clumpy. We can feel it in our chest. We can feel it in our face. The key is we're not acting on our wonderful body signals that tell us you're starting to lose it. Yeah. So maybe the first step on all of this is take the next week after you figure out your kid's stress signs with another 3x5 card, walk around the house and start to acknowledge, when is your child most likely to be stressed and what that stress looks like? And he's not going to get time out for it. You're going to do something golden and saying, I noticed something, sweetie, right before you do the time test. Maybe there's a trigger for it. Or I noticed right before your nap, or if you don't get the nap, this is what you do. If each child knows their stress sign, it's going to be golden. And by the way, all you have to do is ask your kid what your stress sign is and they'll tell you. They know ours. They don't know theirs. My kids would tell me, you do that weird thing with your eyes, Mom. They're really good at ours, but they don't know theirs. Now, you know their stress signs. And that may take you a week or two or three. If you're really stumbling, and it's hard sometimes, I'm going to empathize with you all as parents. You may want to do something simple, but don't let your kid know you're doing it. Track the behavior on a calendar. When, the time of day, or which day is he most likely to be that real irritableness? And you'll begin to see the pattern. It's always at three, or it's always at two, or it's only on Wednesday. And then you can ask the question, what's going on that day? Is that babysitter correct for the kid? Is there too many activities going on that day? Is there one particular subject that's making them angst? And then what you could do is help him that way. Then what you do, part two. This is a year-long plan, Mr. Chaz. The part two is, how about creating a calm down corner in your house that have your kids help you create it? Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be in the living room and you don't have to buy a darn thing. But the key question on this is, what helps us calm down? What would you need in the calm down corner? Kids can later transfer it to their bedroom, but it could be bean bags. For little kids, it could be their blankie or their teddy bear. for bigger kids. I got a 14-year-old who told me it was his goldfish. I said, what's so good about the goldfish? I just watch it go round and round. It really helps me breathe.
That worked for you.
Yeah, okay, not for me, but whatever. And that's the key. What works for the kid? And right. Then when you have that in place, you can say, looks like you're starting to get irritated. And what will happen after a while is the kid will go to the calm down corner without you having to acknowledge it or tell him. The final thing is the best thing I've learned anywhere in the world. I've worked on 18 Army bases on training counselors. And one of the commanders said, you should be talking to the Navy SEALs because we're revamping their brains by retraining them. I mean, the most elite forces we have. I asked them, what are you guys doing differently? It's the simplest thing. And they said, why aren't you guys teaching this to kids? The first thing is we spend a lot of time identifying our stress signs. We point it out to each other, getting irritable. That's what you're doing. But the first thing I just shared with you is what Navy SEALs do. The second thing, as soon as they feel the stress go up, they tell themselves inside their head, chill or relax, some kind of a counter to it. And then they take a 1-2 breath. And if you do it right, it is the fastest way to relax and doesn't cost a dime. It takes a lot of practice, but it is incredible. You take it slow from your abdomen. You tell a little kid, it's like you're breathing up a flower, like smelling a flower. You take the breath like you're writing it all the way up from your abdomen at the top of your head. Oh, it takes so much time to practice and keep feeling the breath, but keep feeling it. And then when you get it up to the top, that's your one. You're going to slowly let it out like you're blowing out a birthday candle. But the exhale must be twice as long as the inhale. If you do that and you keep teaching your child that, they can do it any place, anytime. UC Berkeley put monks and Navy SEALs who practice it over and over again, their part of their brain where self-control and compassion is had doubled in size. They had rewired their brain from just breathing.
From acknowledging that they were triggered and then, so like some kind of like mantra, some kind, and then breathing is whatever. And is that what you would suggest or recommend that parents and teachers do when they're in a moment and they're
Yes, because the problem is, and let's get real serious on this. I'm so glad you brought it up. Remember back to those caring champions that Emmy Werner discovered? One of the qualities of a caring champion is they're calm. Now let's look at all of us. We're just like overwhelmed and fatigued, and our stress mirrors down to our children. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the most interesting studies with the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American Psychological Association, they looked at hundreds of studies on parenting, hundreds of big time studies. What they wanted to do was find out what are the most effective parenting strategies that really will help us raise better kids, you know, kids who make it their own potential. And they came down with 10. Number one on the list was the no-brainer. We love them for who they are and we create structure in our home. So it was a love them and like them. But number two on the list had nothing to do with the kids. We handle our own stress so that it doesn't mirror to our children. So when you admit, oh my gosh, I need to work on it, here's the key. The best way to learn any skill is by teaching it to another person. Mm-hmm. So how about we parents teach it to our kids? It won't just help our kids. It'll help us until pretty soon your kid will politely say to you, it looks like you need a 1-2 breath, mom.
Yes, they will say it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So teach it to yourself and then teach it to your children. And would you suggest if, let's say, someone is struggling to teach it to themselves? Right. Yeah. Because it's easier to say, things are always going to be easier to say than they are to do. You know, how do you suggest like therapy would be helpful for them or?
Absolutely. Anything that works for you is what you got to do. And I think the piece is, first of all, start with looking at YouTube tapes. There's some really good ones out there. Quick little ones. Make sure they're quality. And for gosh sakes, look at the expert who's telling you what to do and make sure they're credentialed and know it. But the first thing is maybe you watch. A second thing that you could do, you got to figure out what works for you, is that they discovered, this is UC Santa Cruz, that if you, a woman, tell another woman what your goal is, You are far more likely to succeed at your goal because your girlfriend is going to make you accountable. So how you doing on that goal? So maybe it's find somebody who's a like-minded person who supports you, your cheerleader. We need cheerleaders. Maybe you also get yourself into a group of other parents. There's a number of parents who are doing yoga groups together because they want to get their act together for themselves so they can help their kids. There's no right or wrong way to do it. But anytime, here's number four. It's called the two index. You're seeing too different of a change in yourself that's lasting too long, that's not normal, and you're too worried, and it's spilling over in too many other areas. That's your red flag. Get help. Start with your doctor and ask him, do you have suggestions or people in the area that you'd recommend? And then another thing you may want to do is before you go signing up for the person, interview him on the phone. Do you feel like that's a good match for you?
That's a lot of really, really great advice. Really appreciate that. So we're going to move on to the next one. And we're going to talk about integrity. How do you teach integrity?
Well, this is a wonderful one, only because I discovered the answer while I was sitting on the killing fields in Cambodia, crying myself silly as to how could people be so cruel. I mean, I had a crying jag. I got up from a bench, walked outside thinking there's no hope for the world, and found one book that changed my life. And it was called The Altruistic Personality by a social psychologist, American, named Samuel Oliner. Now, just a quick little story about Samuel. At age 12, living in Poland, he was Jewish and his whole family was slaughtered off into a death camp. But his stepmother said, run, 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 Samuel, go save yourself. And so he did. And this perfect stranger named Bewinda opened the door and said, come, Samuel. The fascinating thing what now happened was he has now spent, after his life was saved, trying to figure out what makes the windows of the world. How come that woman had such integrity? So what he did was interview hundreds of rescuers that we're not aware of, but there was dozens of hundreds of Christian rescuers who saved Jews during the Holocaust. He interviewed them one by one and figured out and asked point blank, how did you get that way? And every one of them said, it was how I was raised. Oh, please do tell. Three E's kept coming up. So these are the three E's we implement in our home. Number one is that they all said their parents were examples of it. If they were to sit and wonder about now, my dad demonstrated kindness every day. My mom was so honest. My dad was socially responsible. You got to see it in action. So don't tell your child to be honest. Show them how to be honest by you being the model. The second one, it was expected in the house. There was a clear discipline that if you walked over the line, that was not honest. And in this house, that's how we are. So it was expected, and the kids developed that mindset. The third thing was experiences. The parent just didn't show them and tell them expected, but had them actually go and do it. They developed social responsibility and empathy, which are the two highest traits of a rescuer that kept coming up, by simple little not rescuing and saving somebody's life the first day, but giving an overcoat to the man next door, or looking and maybe giving extra cookies for a person who was. After a while, what happened was the child developed a mindset. I am a caring person. This is who I am. I have to do this. And so when push came to shove, they had to step in because it was so ingrained in them of who I am. That's so golden because it's so simple and so science-backed. So I guess the first thing is just to ask yourself, if your kid had only your behavior today to see, what would he have caught? Which makes us all feel guilty. Character is on a nosedive in this country. I think the adults are behaving very, very badly. There are some good ones out there. Let's start showing them the good ones. Let's start showing them the examples of goodness and let's emulate those. Let's give them heroes. There's wonderful right now. Oh my gosh. The back page of the newspaper is filled with incredible stories of goodness. Real kids, real people. I mean, you're talking about the president of Ukraine that should be on the top of your refrigerator right now. That's what goodness looks like. And that's who we are as a family. Find people that you want your kid to look up to, and that'll help your child develop and ingrain those values that are so near and dear.
So what I'm really hearing is that to develop integrity, it's to give them models of it. Us being models, but also other, you know, other role models in society that they look up to.
Yes.
And really building a culture around integrity.
Oh, I love that. I love that culture. Oh my gosh, do we need a culture of integrity? Yeah. My gosh, give me one, because it's after a while, you just become doomed and gloomed of the world. But the other thing is, it becomes, you're clearly intentional. You notice what those parents did is they intentionally decided that they were going to raise moral kids. And it wasn't a one-time lecture at 6 o'clock. It was over and over and over. I think a great question for every parent is to sit down and say, okay, pretend your kid is 40. What are the values you want to see in him or her when she's grown? If you identify those values now, those virtues now, what you'll be able to do is use everyday moments to weave them in. And that's what you're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. I love all that. It makes me think, I remember there was a very small moment, but it made me think like, wow, like this is, she's modeling integrity for her child. And it was something super simple. It was the last vacation I took, and I was at the bar, I was getting a drink, and the line was long. I'm just kind of watching, observing as I normally do.
Yeah.
And what happened was the bartender was really busy and said, oh, hey, you're next. Like, what do you want? And then the woman was with her child and said, so-and-so was actually here first. They can go ahead and we'll go next. And something as small, simple as that, I think is a really great example of what you're talking about.
I love that example, because I think a big mistake we do as parents is try to make things too hard, too difficult, too exhausting, and we're burnt out, and then we don't get the results. If I've learned anything on all the work on resilience, number one is that thrivers are made, not born. And number two, ordinary, simple little things can make extraordinary differences if you intentionally do them in the moment. It's not like you're going to plan at 3 o'clock, we're going to talk about this. It's that day-to-day moment in that bar, you're first. It's saying thank you. It's saying, oh my gosh, look at that article that just came up. Oh, I would love to have him as my son. And why? Those are the things you're looking for. It's targeting, example, accentuating it. And the other thing we do wrong, or we don't do nearly enough, we don't catch the kid doing it. We praise so well of when they come home, what you get. It's all about the test score and the GPA. But how glorious for the child to come home and say, what kind thing did you do today, sweetie pie? So those are the moments in our praise that the child begins to realize, I guess they want me to be kind. I guess that matters, because she's acknowledging it. In the day-to-day moments, catch them in the act. That's so much more powerful than...
And it shows what you value. It shows your values.
Exactly.
The culture you're trying to create in your family. I love it. I'm not going to jump up to one, because I'm really curious about this one. Perseverance is what I'm curious about. How do you teach perseverance?
Some of the best studies in the world give us the clues. Carol Dweck's work on growth mindset is the model to go for, because her work with thousands of children tells us what we can do. Perseverance is stretchable. The first thing we got to do right on perseverance is make sure our expectations are correct. And I would say best expectation is like a rubber band. Figure out what your kid is capable of doing right now, not 2 years before. Because everybody's kind of on a downslide developmentally from COVID. What is he capable of right now? And then gently stretch him like a rubber band without snapping him. One step more. If you don't know his abilities, get on board with the teacher. What are you capable of doing? The second thing that is so mind-bogglingly simple, but this is when Olympic athletes will tell you that's how they won the gold medal, is that their coach never said, you're going to win the gold medal. Instead, what the coach would do is say, yesterday you were here. Today you're going to go one step more. It was one step, one step, one step, one step. In your house, make success be a gain. A four-letter word. Yesterday you were here. I know you're on 35. Now today you're going to go for 36. It makes it more realistic. And then Carol Dweck says, stop praising the end product. What you get? Was that 100%? She says, stop. It's not helping the child, because they're becoming so overwhelmed with, did I get it right? Instead, what you do is backtrack and go, hey, you're really putting in the effort. Oh my gosh, I love how hard you're working. If a child realizes that effort is what's going to create the success, he'll be far more likely to keep on pushing, keep on pushing. And that's what you really want. Agency, that means the kid has the control. Here's another thing that I'm seeing. I'll give you an example. Me way back when with piano teachers, Mr. White was my first piano teacher, and he was not my favorite guy in the world. He was an incredible musician, but he had this thing where if you made one mistake, I don't care where you were in the piece that you were playing in front of him, you had to start all over again. What happened was I would only start worrying about the mistake. Mm-hmm. I got so stressed, I began to hate piano mm-hmm. over and over and over. And then I'd make more and more and more mistakes. Bless Mrs. Thompson. That was my next piano teacher. And she had a different version that was very much the growth mindset model. She'd figure out what my little stumbler was. That's what she'd called it. She says, let's zero in on that bar here, Michelle. Let's practice it over and over. Oh, no, no. Let's practice it over. Oh, you got it, Michelle. You got it. Now start at the beginning. What happened is I started to like piano again. And I also started to breathe. My stress went down. And I wasn't so worried about the mistake because she helped me figure out how to get through it. And that's the same thing a coach does. They never say, you might as well give up. They say, let's go rewind the tape. Oh, there's that one little thing. Your foot's going the wrong way. If you put your foot going that way and kick, your ball's going to go further. Mm-hmm. So emphasize effort. Help the child with the one little stumbler. Find one thing he can do right and keep practicing and practicing it, and make your whole family's goal be a gain. Where were you before? Where you are now? Expectations are like a rubber band, and that's how we stretch perseverance.
I want to take a little kind of a break from the flow a little bit and kind of shift it. You mentioned earlier about like these are the same things that we need in organizations as leaders, right?
And yes.
I want to hear more about that, what your perspective is on kind of what is how we traditional leadership does, and you know, are we getting it right? Or is traditional leadership, do they follow kind of this thriver mentality? Where do you see that we typically get it wrong? Where do we typically get it right? Like, I just want to hear what your thoughts are.
Well, I thank you for asking the question, because I just wrote an article for ASCD on how to future-proof kids. And what they wanted me to do was take the 7 traits and figure out how those 7 traits would help kids in employability later on. So what I did was look through all of the work on confidence is number one. When you look at the Gallup, and if you are a brand new employee going into the workplace, chances are you're going to get a book called Clifton Strengths, and you're going to go through it, and they're going to say, identify your strengths. Because if you know your strengths, you're going to be far more productive. And that's what we want to know, is what you're good at. So the first thing is, out in the real world, leaders look for acknowledging what their employer's strengths are. Second of all, fascinating, Jim Collins from Good to Great, incredible book, right? Mm-hmm. But what is his version of a good leader based on companies that have actually changed the paradigm and been able to stretch their performance and financial stability in terms of over the top? The leader is humble and empathetic. The leader is humble and empathetic. And as a result, he's far more likely to stretch the potential of everybody because he's non-judgmental there for his employers. And there's the possibility. The whole goal in each one of those is fascinating to me on creativity. We didn't hit the curiosity number 5, but if you were to look at what is the future of the world and what are they saying, we have got to be able to make sure, other than empathy, because it's going to be an artificial intelligence, digitally driven, technologically advanced world, that we better keep social connection and not robots in our world. Empathy is first, says Harvard. But the second thing is, we need innovators. We need people who constantly think outside the box, because your job market is going to, for our kids, be so different that 63% of the jobs right now won't be there by the time your kid graduates. What will help the child is to be able to be a brainstormer, to be able to say, I got this, I'll figure out another way. Well, that didn't work, and not be dumbfounded with a failure, What we discover is the best innovators take failure as, okay, I got this. What am I going to do differently? You know, Mr. Chaz, the coolest place I've ever been to is each chapter in Thrivers was to visit a place that's doing this brilliantly right. So where did I go when I dumped curiosity? The place that has probably the smartest people and best inventions anywhere in the world, and that's in Cambridge, the MIT Multimedia Lab. Surrey, artificial intelligence, robots, name something huge. It's being invented there. So I talked to the founder of it, and I said, I walked in, and first of all, I got to tell you, you see IQ points coming out of people's heads. They're the most brilliant minds in the world. But I saw something that we don't do as schools and we don't do as homes. The first thing he says, number one, is you got to make it playful. And so the fascinating thing is I'm walking in and here's these brains that are unbelievable, neuroscientists and mathematicians. And by the way, they're interdisciplinary. It isn't science class and math class. It's neurosurgeons versus mathematicians versus educational psychologists all working together. The second thing is they have Legos in front of them. I said, what are you guys doing? They go, well, you know, if you play, your brain works a lot better. So they were actually developing things, and passion was huge. You can invent anything you want as long as it betters humanity. So the most brilliant things in the world are there. But the final thing is it's in a playful attitude. It's play. And they said, and it's clearly to every single person there, you better make a mistake, because if you don't make a mistake, you're never going to get better at it. If you don't make a mistake, you won't figure out how to increase your potential and increase and figure out what to do better with that invention. What do? Our kids give up with the first mistake. They're so afraid of the failure. And there comes the part that when adversity hits, they're going to give up. You don't want that. You want a child who's going to thrive no matter whatever comes their way. And if you use that kind of a mindset, coolest thing I ever saw is many schools, and you can do this in your own garage, they're creating tinker labs. That is extra typewriters in the olden days, phones, computers, they're all broken. You put them on a table and you have your kid go tinker. I've had more kids tell me that's the best part of the whole school day. After school, we go to tinker lab. Yeah. I said, what's so cool about it? You just tinker, you figure stuff out. And I think about that. And I read, you know, the biography of Steve Jobs. That's what his dad did in the garage. He just developed gadgets for this kid to just go tinker in the garage. And it reduces your stress, keeps your creativity and your innovative spirit alive. And that's what we've got to have for our kids. Mm.
You mentioned in your, you know, description of how to build perseverance, you were talking about focusing on the growth mindset and focusing more on the process. You know, we've in this conversation, we've hit parenting, we've talked about leadership a little bit. Now I want to talk about schools a little bit. It seems to me that that's not the way a lot of our, you know, our school system is set up with grade. It's a very much focus on the product. Like you were saying, what is that end result, that end grade, that GPA? It's less of like, what was the process of learning it? And what was that experience like for you? And that, like, that anxiety that you get, that focus that you were talking about, like that one mistake you were making, you know, I know I've experienced it myself and just know children and people in general, when they're taking tests, they're having that kind of anxiety too, or not even just taking tests when they're learning. It's like, it's, is this going to be on the test, right? It's not about like, and even, you know, teachers are pressured and are pushed to teach to the test, right? Teach for the product, for that grade. Yes. It seems to me that that is the opposite of all the skills and everything that you talked about that we want to build thus far. And I want to hear what your thoughts are on
that. Well, I am with you 1000%, because I'm now interviewing kids. And one of the things that they say is really, really, really stressful is obviously the GPA and the test scores, and their stress levels are over the top. Now, one of the things that's also fascinating on that is I say, what would reduce your stress? And the first thing they say to me is, please tell my parent, do not always focus on the GPA, but tell me that no matter what happens, they'll still love me.
Yeah.
Oh, it just kills me. Yeah. They don't want to disappoint us is the first thing. Yeah. Because we put so much effort on it and we become so test driven and so GPA driven. So I think that's the first thing is realign ourselves. The second thing, I am seeing a slow but filtering process when a lot of people are getting away from just the GPA. Do you know that over, I can't remember the exact number, but I think it's 85 colleges just signed a pledge that said, we are so concerned about our kids' anxiety and stress that we're the first thing they're doing is taking a deliberate nosedive into the kids' those little things called resumes to make sure that the resume isn't parent-driven and the resume is what is strength-driven based on the kid's purpose, what drives you. Yes. What they want is the kid who knows themselves, and that's back to self-confidence 101. Bill Damon, I think, is our best adolescent psychiatrist we've got. He's at Stanford. He's seen that over the last 30 years, every kid coming in, oh, he says they're so smart. There's the smartest generation we've ever had. They're you know, their 4.0s are now 8.3s. But the problem is that they're empty and they're not prepared for life. So one of the things that's so, I mean, look at this, that one of the things that high schools are now doing is senior year, they're developing something called the Capstone Project. The Capstone Project is each kid takes a moment or a semester to figure out who they are. How sad is that? To write an essay of here's who I am. Here's what I've discovered about myself. There's a digital portfolio of not my grades, but my passions. Here's what I'm collecting about myself. And then they give the speech to the teachers and their peers because they this varsity blues thing about the parents spending all this money to create the kid's resume wasn't helping the kids. So there's a slow backlog on it. The fascinating thing, if you look at Bill Damon and some of the best psychiatrists we have, they all go back to help your kid identify their strengths because that's going to be their passion and that will be their purpose. And if you know your purpose and your passion and you want a happy kid, you'll develop what University of Chicago says, flow. You want a kid who's really going to be able to be engaged and excited about their job. Put him in what their passion is, what I want to be, not what parents want to be. And I think that's an aha moment for us all. Follow the who of your child, not the what you want.
That's so powerful. And I just did a whole podcast episode, that last part about how to get into college and finding like your passion and your core values. Yeah. And so that everything you said is really powerful. And I love how that just connects so easily. Those who are listening, go back and listen to the last episode to hear us talk about for a whole hour, but we're going to wrap it up right now and tell people where you can tell us about your book. This is plug, do your plugs.
Thank you. Well, I first of all, I appreciate all of you. This has been a long 40-year journey, but I think I finally did it. Thrivers is now out in paperback this week. It's obviously on Amazon. It's in digital or audio form. If you have any, what should I do and where do I start with the book? It is not a book that you read from start to finish. You take the assessment tool at the very beginning. You figure out what your child's natural strengths are, and then you nosedive into which chapter or which skill set your kids need. And also, this is a parenting book that's supposed to last, hopefully, from toddler to teen and there above. It's going to be the new rebooting that I think we all need to do. It's a new world that we're raising our children in. GPA is not going to be the index of success. The index is going to be whether the child has these skills to be able to bounce back and hold the uncertainty, the fear, the stress that's mounting. We can do this because resilience is teachable, but we got to be a little craftier and do it one step at a time. And that's how we'll make a difference and raise a strong pandemic generation who thrives.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?